Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You know, in life, no matter how much you are down, if you are willing to give your best and fight, you know, you can always have a fighting chance to come back.
We had to rise from the ashes.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Monday, the 24th of June. Gunmen attacked churches, a synagogue and a police checkpoint in the Russian Republic of Dagestan. Several police officers and an Orthodox priest were killed. Russia blames the US for a Ukrainian missile attack on occupied Crimea, which left at least 4 people dead. And Saudi Arabia says more than 1,300 pilgrims died during this year's Hajj. Also in the podcast, French women march against the far-right national rally.
I'm here because I'm a woman and I don't want my rights to be taken from me because some far-right movement wants to take the power in France.
And
we'll once again welcome a new pair of giant pandas to the Smithsonian's National Zoo and Conservation Biology Institute in Washington, D.C.
Pandemonium in the U.S., get it? Sparked by China's offer of 2 new bears. But we begin in the Russian Republic of Dagestan. Gunmen opening fire on a street in the regional capital, Mahachkala. It was one of 2 cities in the mainly Muslim region which came under attack. In Dabient, 125 kilometres south along the Caspian Sea, a synagogue and an Orthodox church were attacked and set on fire. A second Orthodox church and a police checkpoint were also targeted. As we record this podcast, the authorities say at least 10 people were killed, mostly police officers, but including a Russian Orthodox priest. In Mahachkala, people fled in panic from a beach, while there were also reports of gunmen attacking a police car in a village. I got more details about the assault from Famil Ismailov from the BBC Russian service.
Well, although we know that the authorities announced that the active phase of counter-terrorist operation, as they call it, has now finished. But they still keep the roads leading out of Mahachkala completely locked down. The city's in lockdown. They're looking for any possible attackers and people who were associated with them. But we definitely know that 6 attackers had been killed, 4 in Mahachkala, 2 in Derbent. And we know that at least 10 people are dead, and 8 of them police officers, and 25 injured. The shootout at the village that you mentioned, that is probably the reports about the apprehension of a local official from that village, someone called Magomed Amarov. Apparently, and that's what the reports say, his 2 sons and a nephew were among the fighters attacking the churches and synagogues.
Yeah, I mean, so these were what, coordinated attacks, and do we know who by?
It sounds like they're absolutely coordinated. It basically started absolutely all the same time. The question of who is behind it is a very difficult one because we definitely don't know who was organizing the attack. However, last October, when Hamas attacked Israel, the strange riots happened in Mahachkala International Airport because somebody spread the rumor that apparently Jewish settlers, refugees, are coming to Mahachkala and the riots have started and men of, you know, sort of fighting age men have taken over the building of the airport and even the airfield. And police was unable to do anything. So the fact that there is an undercurrent that we don't know exactly, the Islamist kind of undercurrent, that we don't know exactly how it operates, where it comes from, probably still exists there.
And of course, this region, Dagestan bordering Chechnya, has a history of violence. Will it be worrying the authorities in Moscow?
Absolutely, because what happened in the 90s when Chechen was spread violence from Chechnya to Dagestan as well, it was the clash of 2 kinds of Islam. Dagestan is a conservative Muslim country, that's correct, but the Islam practice there is Sufi Islam, much more peaceful and more meditative. The Islam practiced in Chechnya was and is Wahhabi Islam, so and much more radical. So we can see that there's a possible clash within Dagestan itself that could also spread over into other Islamic republics of Northern Caucasus. And that definitely should be worrying authorities in Moscow.
Famil Ismailov of the BBC Russian service. Meanwhile, Russia says the United States is responsible for a Ukrainian attack on occupied Crimea, which killed at least four people, including three children. The Russian Defense Ministry said the Black Sea port of Sevastopol, which Moscow annexed in 2014, was targeted by US-supplied ATACMS missiles, one of which exploded above a beach. Julian Marshall got the details from our security correspondent, Gordon Carrera, in Kiev.
What we know comes from Russian officials who have said that a number of these ATACM missiles were fired and that four were intercepted by their air defences, but they say one, a fifth, detonated mid-air and then rained down shrapnel, they say, on a beach at Sevastopol, leading to over 100 wounded, they say, and a number dead. Not likely to have been the intended target, more likely a military target, a base perhaps nearby.
And is this the first time that Ukraine has used these ATACM missiles on Crimea?
No, what I think significant is these are an important tool in their armoury as they see it, because they have the ability to go much longer range than some of the other weapon systems, up to 300 kilometres, which from the Ukrainian point of view allows them to hit deeper behind Russian lines, and particularly supply lines, bases, and Crimea has been one of the targets. I think what's significant is the Russians are blaming the US, saying that it was US specialists who programmed the coordinates for these missiles using US satellite data, as well as the weapons themselves having been US supplied, and saying from the Russian Foreign Ministry that they'll be raising this in the international community.
Could I just turn to Kharkiv, a city in northeast Ukraine, which has come under Russian attack for the second day in a row?
Yes, that's right. Another attack from Russian glide bombs on Kharkiv. Yesterday, those glide bombs hit some manufacturing facilities and a residential building, killing a woman who just got off a trolley bus. Today, it looks like an educational building was hit with more casualties. So part of what seems to be a sustained campaign against that city, which is close to where the Russians have been trying to push down in the last month or so militarily. So it looks like part of that wider offensive is to try and put pressure on the city. And more broadly, we've seen the Russian aerial attacks targeting civilian infrastructure, particularly in terms of the energy infrastructure across Ukraine as well, which has led to the Ukrainians calling for more air defences.
Haven't the Ukrainians been given permission by the United States to use those US-supplied long-range missiles to attack inside Russia in the vicinity of Kharkiv? Has that happened yet?
The Americans were reluctant to allow those weapons to be used over the border into Russia, because they were concerned that that could be seen as an escalatory step. But the US confirmed recently that it would allow those. Particularly, I think the concern was that around that Kharkiv area, because of the Russian advances around a month ago, that there was a danger of a kind of serious pushback of Ukrainian defences. The concern was it's quite close to the border there, that to be able to deal with the supply lines and the Russian forces building up, that they needed to be able to attack over the border. So, yes, the permission was given by the US.
Gordon Carrera in Kiev talking to Julian Marshall. The Israeli military has admitted that its soldiers violated operating procedures when they tied a wounded Palestinian man to a military vehicle during a raid in the occupied West Bank. Israel said he was a suspect who was wounded in an exchange of fire in Jenin and was eventually transferred to the Red Crescent. The West Bank, the larger of the two Palestinian territories, has seen an upsurge in violence since the war in Gaza began. The Israeli Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant, is currently visiting the US to discuss the conflict with Hamas, as well as tensions with the Lebanese group Hezbollah. I spoke about that to our correspondent in Jerusalem, Sebastian Usher, but first I asked him, what do people in Israel make of the video showing the man strapped to a jeep?
To be honest, I haven't seen a huge reaction to it in Israel. There's been more reaction to some of the more aggressive behaviour by the police in Israel itself on Saturday night when they were dealing with the latest anti-government protests and demonstrators demanding that the Netanyahu government do all it can to get the remaining hostages out. There's been a lot about that. There's a piece from an Israeli newspaper, the Jerusalem Post. It expresses a viewpoint that would be shared, I think, by many, essentially saying the UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese accused the IDF of using this Palestinian man as a human shield. Now, the reaction in the Jerusalem Post and its editorial is to say that this is completely ridiculous and unfair, since it's Hamas which uses human shields. And as we know, this has been an accusation that the Israeli military, the Israeli government, has made about Hamas for years and years, but specifically in the context of the current conflict in Gaza, where the government officials have said that Hamas essentially is responsible for civilian casualties in Gaza as Israel tries to target senior Hamas commanders and fighters by positioning the sites where they are sheltering, hiding out, however you want to put it, close to where civilians are. So essentially saying that it's Hamas who uses human shields. But I mean, again, this is a very, very bad, negative image for Israel to go around the world. This video has gone viral. If you take away the accusation that potentially the man was being used as a human shield, the way that he's described his treatment, his family as well, is pretty extreme. I mean, he had been wounded and he says that he was basically waiting for ambulances for 1 to 2 hours and then was manhandled and thrust up onto this truck and bound to it in the heat of the day. So he had the metal burning into him as well. So he says that the injuries he had already sustained were made much worse by this.
And not ideal for these images to be beamed around the world as the Israeli Defence Minister is in Washington.
Yes, I mean, he is there, Yoav Gallant, to speak to his counterpart, senior US officials, about where not just the conflict in Gaza, but potentially a widening and a bigger conflict opening up on Israel's northern border with Hezbollah and Lebanon itself, where that might go. There's been a lot of rhetoric from both sides in the past week or two, which has really raised huge concern that after Gaza, Lebanon may be next in the sights of the Israeli army and the Israeli government.
Sebastian Usher in Jerusalem. The government of Saudi Arabia has given the first official death toll for this year's Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca, which took place during an extreme heat wave. Pilgrims that register with the authorities can take advantage of facilities like air-conditioned tents and official Hajj transport, but nearly 500,000 of the pilgrims were not on authorised trips. Yusuf Taha has the details.
The Saudi Health Minister, Fahd Al-Jalajil, said that 1,301 pilgrims had lost their lives, with 83% of them being unregistered. Mr. Al-Jalajil said they had walked long distances in searing heat, which at times exceeded 50 degrees Celsius, with no shelter, while many were elderly with long-term illnesses. Saudi Arabia has been criticized for not doing more to make the Hajj safer, especially for unregistered pilgrims who have no access to facilities such as air-conditioned tents and official Hajj transport.
Yusuf Taha. Last year, China took back its pandas from the Smithsonian National Zoo in Washington, D.C., leaving the city without any for the first time since 1972. But two more pandas are on their way. They should arrive by the end of the year. Toby Luckhurst reports from the U.S. Capitol on the mounting excitement.
We'll once again welcome a new pair of giant pandas to the Smithsonian's National Zoo and Conservation Biology Institute in Washington, D.C.
Pandas have been at D.C. Zoo since 1972, when the Chinese gifted a pair to President Richard Nixon's wife, Pat. But tensions are high between Washington and Beijing, and D.C.'s pandas will return to China in November of 2023. The announcement of two new bears came last month in a slick marketing video featuring First Lady Dr. Jill Biden.
We can't wait to celebrate this historic moment here in our nation's capital. Join us. It's official. The pandas are coming back to D.C.
You might be able to hear some building work behind me where they're preparing for the arrival of the new pandas. There are banners all over the place screaming, "The pandas are coming." in big block letters.
I read a line at the end of 2024.
And there's already a ton of merchandise in the shops here. I can see mugs, t-shirts, necklaces, building blocks, magnets, toys, obviously, hoodies, I mean, anything you could possibly imagine with a panda on it. This looks like very good business for the zoo. I'm sure they can make a lot of money through their merchandise. But, of course, it's very good business for the Chinese. The pandas are out on loan. They're not kept forever in the US. The Smithsonian revealed it will pay $1 million a year to China to fund conservation and research efforts there. So it makes a lot of sense for them to do it. And, of course, it's not just a money spinner. There's diplomacy at work as well.
Huge soft power in this. Children all over the United States love pandas now.
Dennis Wilder was a senior CIA official, but he now serves as a senior fellow at Georgetown University here in the U.S. Capitol.
The soft power has worked. When China looks at how bad its reputation is in the United States, what it's hoping for is a new generation of Americans who are going to have a different attitude. And indeed, if you look at the polling numbers, younger Americans have a more positive attitude of China than older Americans. And part of it is pandas.
Mr. Wilder told me that although relations between D.C. and Beijing have sunk even lower over issues like the Russian invasion of Ukraine or claims in the South China Sea, neither power sees a reason to make things worse this year.
Right now, there is what I would call uncomfortable coexistence. We are barely stable in the relationship right now. But both sides have reason not to have it blow up in 2024.
Dennis Wilder, ending that report by Toby Luckhurst. And still to come on the Global News podcast.
Yeah, I walked in and first thing was the smell. It just smelled everything. All the weed, all the human stuff.
The man whose family home was turned into a cannabis farm.
Hi, I'm former Wales international footballer Robert Earnshaw. And in Copper Bullets, a new four-part series from Amazing Sports Stories, I'm exploring how my birth country, Zambia, overcame the devastating loss of their national football team in 1993.
Zambia has had its biggest blow ever in the history of the country.
I kept asking myself, how do we honor these people?
We had to rise from the ashes.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
There has been widespread anger on Indian social media after a crucial entrance test for postgraduate medical courses was postponed with just hours to go. The Health Ministry called it a precautionary measure after allegations of irregularities and cheating in other entrance tests. And Barasan Etirajan reports.
More than 200,000 doctors had been registered to appear for Sunday's NEET PG exam, nearly half of them women. One doctor on social media said she had travelled all the way from Dubai to take the exam and had spent more than $1,000 to prepare for the test. Another candidate said, I can't put my anger into words. Does the government know how frustrating this is? The government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi is facing severe criticism over the alleged lack of oversight and integrity in the handling of crucial entrance exams. On Saturday night, it sacked the head of the National Testing Agency after allegations of irregularities in the undergraduate medical entrance exam. Opposition parties and student groups have been holding protests across the country.
Our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etirajan. If the polls are to be believed, France could see a seismic victory for the far right in the upcoming parliamentary election. On Sunday, thousands of women took to the streets of Paris and other cities to voice their opposition to Marine Le Pen's national rally. One of those who took part was Shirley Wirden of the French Communist Party.
We are witnessing a comeback to an archaic order that women can't tolerate. And it's also a culture of hate that feminists have always abhorred, because feminists have always developed international solidarity, a culture of peace, which is in total contradiction with the values of the National Rally.
Well, the National Rally rejects claims that it will erode women's rights and says it's actually seen its support among women rise. I heard more about the demonstration from Catherine Norris-Trent, a senior correspondent for France 24.
There were thousands of people protesting. These demonstrations were in Paris. They were in other cities across France too. And they had been called for by feminist organizations. More than 200 had called these protests to warn about what they say are the dangers for women under a potential far-right government. They've been saying things about the right to get an abortion, traditional views of lots of members of the National Rally, Marine Le Pen's party. They fear that it could lead to a regression in terms of how women are viewed in French society.
And does the National Rally hold these views? Does it plan these kind of things if it gets into power?
Well, the potential prime minister for the National Rally, 28-year-old Jordan Bardella, put out a video explicitly denying that the National Rally would be a threat to women's rights. He said that by fighting insecurity, which a lot of people take to mean that he's equating insecurity with immigration, he says that by cracking down on that, they'll make the streets of France safer for women. But if you look at recent events in Parliament, the right to an abortion was enshrined in the French Constitution, and only around half of the National Rally's MPs actually voted for that. So some people are pointing to that, saying, look, they're saying they're in favour of women's rights, but when it comes down to it, they're still very conservative.
And yet, despite that, the National Rally seems to be winning over women voters. Why is that?
I think that can be put down to the decline in popularity of other parties in France, including Emmanuel Macron's own party and the traditional left and right wing parties. A lot of voters in France, men and women, are very fed up with the traditional parties, saying that they think the country's in decline, that there's been no progress. So I think that ties into this general discontent and people perhaps hoping that the National Rally might be some kind of alternative, something they haven't tried yet.
Now, the protest today is just the latest against the far right. How does France feel going into these parliamentary elections?
Well, France is pretty on edge ahead of the first round of the elections, which are in 1 week's time. There's a real sense that we don't know what's going to happen here, that we're in uncharted territory. The polling is quite difficult because they're two round elections. So only the top candidate get through the first round of voting, and then there could be head-to-heads or three-way runoffs or even four-way runoffs in some circumscriptions. So it's not clear what the outcome could be. The opinion polls do look like they're pointing towards the National Rally being the biggest party in the French Parliament. Will it have enough to form a government? They said they'll only want to do that if they've got an overall majority and can actually govern, or the country could be plunged into months of political chaos with no party having a majority, being a hung parliament and France basically being ungovernable. So there's a lot of nervousness in France right now.
Catherine Norris Trent of France 24. The Kenyan president, William Ruto, has said he is willing to engage with the young people who've been protesting against planned tax rises. His overture came a day after a second person died from injuries sustained during Thursday's big rally in the capital, Nairobi. In his first public comments, Mr. Ruto praised the demonstrators for raising their voices peacefully. But a protest organiser said he must respond publicly to their demand for him to scrap the tax increase and accused the police of brutalising the protesters. So what should we make of the president's intervention? I asked our Africa regional editor, Richard Kagoe, in Nairobi.
It wasn't quite anticipated because there's been lots of anxiety in the air because you don't quite really know how this is going to end because the government appeared probably because of its silence. They're going to just stand their position. And so this coming from the president today and, striking sort of like a reconciliatory tone, it was a breath of fresh air. Because nobody knew really how this is going to pan out come Tuesday when the young protesters had called for a national strike.
How badly has the government been rattled by the strength of the opposition?
The government could be shaken to the core because, you know, these are protesters. They're young. They're not organized typically like those protests that are led by trade unionists or politicians. So it's a bit difficult, especially for the government, to really tell where this is coming and where it's headed to. So a lot of people would say the government might have been caught off guard when it came to this.
This olive branch from the president, could it be a prelude to a U-turn on the tax rises, or is it merely them perhaps playing for time?
Maybe playing for time, because you know, there are constitutional timelines as to when the finance bill needs to be passed into law. So what happened is when we had debate in parliament and the bill went through its second reading, so a committee was formed and they're supposed to look into some of the proposed amendments and come back to parliament on Tuesday where the bill is going to be debated and subjected to a final vote. So I don't know what would be able to be accomplished between Sunday and Tuesday. I don't know how this is going to be arranged, but a lot of commentators say if it's rejected, it may not necessarily plunge the country into a financial or constitutional crisis.
Richard Kigoi in Nairobi. In a surprise move, the Grand Duke of Luxembourg is to step back from his duties and hand over powers to his son in October. However, Grand Duke Henri will retain his title. Rooster Pooker reports.
When a crown passes on to a new generation, it normally happens through death or abdication, but not so in Luxembourg. The tiny but rich European country has its own way of doing things. There, the Grand Duke appoints a lieutenant representant, in effect a regent who takes over the duties of the head of state. Prince Guillaume was always expected to get the title, but the timing was a surprise. The Grand Duke is only 69 and in good health, despite an angioplasty more than 10 years ago. Like his father before him, he's likely to remain the formal head of state for some years before handing over the throne and the Grand Ducal title to his son.
Rooster Pooker. Renting your home out to strangers can seem like something of a risk. How can you be sure they'll look after it while you're away? But spare a thought for one homeowner in London who returned to find his house transformed into a drug farm. Sophie Smith takes up the story.
Yeah, I walked in and first thing was the smell. You could just smell everything. All the weed, all the human stuff.
When Charles Reeves came home, he couldn't recognise his house. There were wires dangling from holes in the ceiling and mounds of soil covering the floor, in one room reaching almost a metre high. In another, there was an elaborate ventilation system. This is for maintaining the right temperature to grow cannabis, something Mr. Reeves's tenants have been doing while he was away.
I mean, this specifically, this was my bedroom, you know, and, you know, now it's this.
The police have now seized more than 400 cannabis plants from the house. The Reeves family advertised their property online before they moved abroad for work. An estate agent approached them, promising a tenant family who was supposedly working for a city firm. But the tenants never paid any money to Charles and his wife, Julia. And now they're going to have to spend thousands on fixing the damage caused by the masses of soil, faulty wiring and general ruin of their property. Experts say this is a crime that is on the rise in the UK. Alan Morgan is a leading expert witness in criminal drug trials. He says this type of scam has a well-oiled setup.
If you produce a successful crop within, you know, a three-bedroom semi-detached house, you might yield a crop of cannabis that's worth £30,000 to £40,000. So you offset that against the risk of detection. They know that the legal system, if they stop paying the rent, they change the locks on the property, they're not going to be evicted. The legal process for eviction takes so long that they have ample opportunity to complete the crop and then disappear.
The Reeves family are expecting heavy losses, not just financially, but for the home that they have lost.
I did break down. Emotionally, it feels like my home has been defiled. This is the first real home I ever had.
Charles Reeves, ending that report by Sophie Smith. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll and produced by Alison Davis. Our editors, Karen Martin, I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
Hi, I'm former Wales international footballer Robert Earnshaw. And in Copper Bullets, a new four-part series from Amazing Sports Stories, I'm exploring how my birth country, Zambia, overcame the devastating loss of their national football team in 1993.
Zambia has had its biggest blow ever in the history of the country.
I kept asking myself, how do we honor these people?
We had to rise from the ashes.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.